relationship to Jesus. And the real direction and motivation and purpose in life has to come from you and I understanding who we are in relationship to him. And John said something that I didn't pick up on. I had so much in my notes that we didn't cover, but he said that he wasn't even worthy to untie the sandal of Jesus. And untying the sandals was something that disciples didn't do for their rabbis. Slaves or servants untied the sandals of rabbis. And John made a very profound statement then when he said, I'm not even a servant to this man. And so seeing Jesus for who he was and understanding his relationship to him created a real sense of humility. Last week we looked at a totally different person, another man whose name we have, Nicodemus, the teacher in Israel, the scholar in Jerusalem. And he came to Jesus in the evening, and something I didn't tell you last week, but that account begins in the dark and it ends in the dark. Jesus spends a bunch of time talking about those who love darkness, and they run away from the light. And I think John, when he was writing this gospel, even put that transition there because the very next story we get into is in broad daylight. There's just a lot of neat literary things that John did. But Nicodemus came to Jesus, and he came away realizing that there was more to the Messiah than just knowing the scriptures. That there was a sense of mystery about a relationship with God. Jesus used the metaphor of the wind, and that those who are born of the Spirit are like the wind, because it's not something that you can see as much as you can see the fruit of it or the effects of it. And so these two people... And I try to condense it down to one word. We get this idea of seeing Jesus for who he is should produce a sense of humility in us. Seeing Jesus for who he is should produce a sense of mystery in us. Tonight we're going to take a look at a woman that John devotes over 40 verses to. Not all of them dedicated to her, but she's at the center of this story. The woman at the well. And this is an amazing story, and I'm going to follow the same pattern that I've been following the first 2 weeks. We're going to take a look at the world behind the text. We're going to take a look at some things about the geographical area, a little bit about the history. This account in this story, in this gospel, is absolutely dripping with amazing history, and I'm going to try to condense some of it for you. But the mountain, Gerizim, this is an actual picture of it. I've not been there yet. But this is sunset from Mount Gerizim. And the town of Shechem that are mentioned in John chapter 4 are very, very significant things in Jewish history. Matter of fact, let me, as long as I'm wireless, I didn't print this in your notes. I realize that because it would have been too long. And I've tried to provide you with scriptures so that if you do decide to go back and look over this, you'll have a chance to have the scriptures there right next to you. Let me just read this from John chapter 4. You're welcome to read along. I'm reading from the English Standard Version, starting with verse 4. 3, he left Judea and departed again for Galilee. So he's going from the north to the south. And he had to pass through Samaria, so he came to a town of Samaria called Sychar, near the field that Jacob had given to his son Joseph. Jacob's well was there. So Jesus, wearied as he was from his journey, was sitting beside the well. It was about the sixth hour. That would have been noon. John seems to be using Roman time here rather than Jewish time. There came a woman of Samaria to draw water. Jesus said to her, give me a drink. The actual Greek is give to me to drink. It's a very polite request. It's not a demand. He's not being abrasive here. For his disciples had gone away into the city to buy food. So he's there alone. The Samaritan woman said to him, how is it that you, a Jew, ask a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? For Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God, and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him, and he would have given you living water. The woman said to him, sir, you have nothing to draw water with, and the well is deep. Where do you get that living water? Are you greater than our father Jacob? He gave us the well and drank from it himself, as did his sons and his livestock. And Jesus said to her, everyone who drinks of this water will be thirsty again. But whoever drinks of the water that I give him will never be thirsty forever. The water that I give him will become in him a spring of water welling up to eternal life. The woman said to him, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. And Jesus said, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said, you're right in saying I have no husband, for you've had five, and the one you now have is not your husband. What you've said is true. The woman said, sir, I perceive you're a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship. And Jesus said to her, woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when the true worshipers will worship the Father in spirit and in truth. For such people, the Father is seeking to worship him. God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth. The woman said to him, I know that Messiah is coming, he who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell you us all things. And Jesus said to her, I who speak to you am he. And just then his disciples came back. They marveled that he was talking with a woman. But no one said, what do you seek? To her, obviously. Or why are you talking with her? The woman left her water jar, went into the town and said to the people, come see a man who told me all that I ever did. Can this be the Christ? They went out of the town and they were coming to him. That's the background for this story. But Shechem, the city that's mentioned, and Gerizim, Mount Gerizim, which is the mountain, have a tremendous history, a holy history for these people. This is where God appeared to Abram in Genesis 12 and promised him the land. Was near Shechem. This is the beginning of the whole notion of a distinct race, of a distinct nation, of a distinct piece of real estate. The beginning of what you and I are beneficiaries of. Jacob bought land here from the sons of Hamor, Shechem's father. He obviously drilled a well here or dug a well, and he obviously passed the well on in his family. If you read the account of Joseph, when his father sent him out to look for his brothers, before he got thrown into the hole, Shechem was the place that he was directed to search. And it goes on. It just keeps going. Moses, in the book of Deuteronomy, and Joshua later did it in fulfillment of Moses' command. God said, when you enter into the land, I want you to stand in this valley. And I want you to put six tribes on Mount Gerizim. And I want you to put six tribes on Mount Ebal. And I want you to pronounce the blessings and the curses over the people of Israel. And this was a solemn ritual that they did. And while they were there, Joshua set up a huge stone as a memorial stone, as kind of a witness over what was going on there. And in that time, if they obeyed the commands of God, there was all of these things that were going to happen to them. If they didn't, there was all these things that were going to happen to them. So it was a very sacred piece of history. And the Mount of Blessing was Mount Gerizim, not Mount Ebal. When they set up the cities of refuge, those six places in the Jewish geography that were basically within a one day's run of any place in the real estate, where if you accidentally killed someone, you could run to a city of refuge and you were safe there. You had to stay in that place as long as the high priest was alive. But the person, what was called the Avenger of Blood, could chase you there. But if you got to the city of refuge, you were safe. It was an illustration almost of salvation. Shechem was one of those six cities. It was an important city. When they finally brought Joseph's bones back from Egypt, they were buried in Shechem. So this is a place that's got immense, immense history. It's a meaningful place. The city of Sychar and Jacob's well were there. And Jacob drank from the same well that Jesus drank from. That's a very sobering, sobering thought. Almost 2,000 years of history. And if you were to go to the Holy Land today, it's one of the few archaeological sites that all four major world religions agree is legitimate. There's an Orthodox church that's been built over the site since then. But in the early 1900s, you can find, I've got some, I didn't bother to show them, but I've got some pictures of drawings, pencil drawings that people did of the Well of Jacob before they built the church over that site. So this is a place that's got enormous history to anyone that makes a connection to Abram. It was a holy place. And if you follow the long string of things that we just looked at, Gerizim kind of rises to the top as a very, very important place. Very important place in the history of God's people. Longer in importance than Jerusalem, in a very real sense, as far as being a centerpiece of what God was doing. This is a slide of an actual standing stone in Shechem that's there today. But it was also a hostile site. There it had a very heated history, not just a holy history. One of the kings of Israel, and I'm not sure if I've taught this in here before, but around 931, Solomon's son was responsible for making some bad political decisions, and the nation of God's people split into two kingdoms, southern kingdom of Judah and the northern kingdom of Israel. And Israel's kings, every single one of them were wicked, every one of them. And one of them was a king named Omri, and he built the city of Samaria. It was called a city back here. And he had a son named Ahab, who married a woman named Jezebel. And many of you know that story. And they became synonyms for an evil monarchy. But it became a synonym for evil, and it was the capital city for the northern kingdom. So when we read in the book of Kings, you need to understand that by the time we get to Jesus' day, about 700 years later, it's become an entire region. Samaria is now known as a region. But it used to be a city, and it was the capital city of the northern kingdom, just like Jerusalem was the capital city of the southern kingdom. And it kept getting more and more and more wicked. And finally, God, he preached to him. He preached to him through prophets like Amos about the social injustice that was going on in Israel. He preached to him about through the prophet Hosea and begged them. Basically said, you're like a harlot, but I'll still take you back. And they didn't. And so in 722, God sent the leading world empire at that time, the Assyrians, to the northern kingdom, and they obliterated it. And the Assyrians had a really unusual way of conquering. And what they did was they would repopulate an area with foreigners for two reasons. When they came to Israel and conquered Samaria, they hauled the Jews from the northern kingdom. And the scripture tells us at least four places that they put them. They scattered them all out to destroy their national identity and also to inhibit any kind of political alliances being reformed. But they did the same thing in the northern kingdom. They brought in all kinds of Gentiles and brought them in to the northern kingdom. And those people, if you read in the scriptures, and I put those in your notes, they brought in all of their pagan practices with them. And they also intermarried with a lot of the poor Jews that weren't hauled off. And out of that came a mixed race of people known as the Samaritans. And they were despised by the Jews. They were despised because they were not considered to be full-blooded Jews. They were despised because they were considered to be idolaters. And they were despised because they felt like God had judged the northern kingdom, and so they didn't want anything to do with them. But things really started to heat up when the Jews, now the southern kingdom, you'd think the southern kingdom would learn from this. But about 140 or so years later, after prophets like Habakkuk and Jeremiah had preached their guts out to God's people. And they kept saying, look what happened to the northern kingdom. Look what happened to your wicked sister in the north. You need to get your act together. And the Jews in the southern kingdom had a faulty reasoning. They thought it went something like this. What God in his right mind is going to destroy his own hometown? And what God in his right mind would ever destroy his own house? And so they had developed a theology that they were safe in Jerusalem because God would certainly never destroy the Jerusalem. And above all that, he would certainly never destroy the temple. That's why when you read through the book of Jeremiah and you hear Jeremiah say that, thus says the Lord, the temple, the temple, the temple. You know, don't put your confidence in the temple. I'm going to level it. They didn't believe him. They thought he was a quack. But they got hauled off in 586. The Assyrians got conquered by the Babylonians. There's a little lesson in world history, but it's important because it's our history too. And Nebuchadnezzar came in and conquered Jerusalem. It's an awful, awful, awful story. It's in the book of Jeremiah. It's in the book of 2 Kings. Women as sensitive as any sitting in this auditorium tonight were eating their children. It was just an awful time. It was a dark time. And they got hauled off to Babylon. And this is the time of Daniel and Ezekiel and all of that sort of stuff. But then they get to come back, which is the book of Ezra. Cyrus now has conquered the Babylonians. And Cyrus says, I want you to go back and rebuild the temple. So they go back. And if you read the book of Ezra, the first four or five chapters, and you read a little bit of Nehemiah when they're rebuilding the wall, the Samaritans want to help. And there's some names, Sanballat and Tobias and some guys that come in and they want to try to help to rebuild the temple. And Zerubbabel says, no, we will have nothing to do with you. Now, there's two reasons for that. Number one was that the Samaritans wanted to do it for economic reasons. They were not remotely interested in the temple. We know that for sure. But they wanted control of the trade routes, which they had for 70 years when the Jews were gone. And secondly, the Jews didn't want him to help because they represented idolatry, which was the whole reason they got hauled off in the first place. And so there's this hostility that's going on. This is around 400. So it's 4 centuries old by the time Jesus runs into this woman. And somewhere during this time, an alternative temple was built on Mount Gerizim. There's a whole bunch of debate over who built it and when it was built. And I'm not sure. But it was probably 200 or so years before Christ. And it was built. They had their own sacrificial system. Matter of fact, there are 200, and I debated because I knew we'd run out of time. There's 200 Samaritans alive today. It's one of the oldest and smallest groups of extant people on the planet. They still have a Passover. They still sacrifice lambs at Passover. And there's, if you're interested, it's the-samaritans.com that they have a website. This is the 21st century. And there's a ton of information there. Some of it's in Hebrew. It's a Semitic language, and I don't know it. But a temple was built there. It was destroyed about 130 shortly after what was known as the Maccabean Revolt in Jerusalem and a group of people. It's where the celebration of Hanukkah came from, which we know about. But they recaptured Palestine and the high priesthood degenerated into a political mess. And a guy went up and destroyed the Samaritan temple. He destroyed it just like Nebuchadnezzar had done to the Jewish temple. That wouldn't have gone well with political and social relations between Jerusalem and Samaria. And that was just less than 200 years, 130 years before this encounter with this woman. And so we've got, the ruins of that temple were still sitting there on Mount Gerizim when Jesus was talking at this well. And the well of Jacob is in the shadow of Mount Gerizim, and you're just staring right at it. It's there. So all of this is certainly on the mind of this woman. And certainly on the mind of Jesus' disciples. And certainly not on the mind of Jesus. In the sense of having any control or influence over what he did. And that's what we're going to take a look at. It also, as far as the history of this, something special was going to happen here this day. This turns out to be a blessed site with a history that's absolutely amazing. I don't know what goes through your mind when you read the story about the Samaritan woman, the story of five husbands, the fact that she would have been the despicable woman to a Jew. She was also a despicable woman to everyone in Sychar. You need to know that as well. She would have been considered unclean by all of the religious people in Sychar. The Samaritans, beloved, are deeply religious people. And I think we somehow we just have kind of that kind of dripped off somewhere out of our luggage as we're traveling through our learning of the scriptures. The city of Sychar was not a whole lot different than the city of Jerusalem in the sense that it had a priesthood living around it. It had people that worshiped. They had Passover. There was deeply religious people, a little more fanatical than the Jews. And we'll see that in a minute. But she would have been considered unclean by their standards as well. It wasn't just this Samaritan running into this Jew and Jesus having to deal with it. She would have lived with it. She also would have been a very lonely and estranged person. How can I say that? She's gathering water at noon. The well was, I'm trying to think what the closest place is to it in our culture. Closest thing to it probably for a lot of women, and this has changed a lot in the last couple decades, but would probably be the grocery store on a Saturday. When people are out shopping and they're running into people that you haven't seen all week because of this or that, the well was like that. It was a place where gossip and information and what's happening with your kids and did you hear and did you know was going on. And she was barred from all that. She was barred from all that from the regular people in the city because she was considered a woman of ill repute. How can I say all that? Because of when she came to get water. You know, you have to have an IQ about the size of your shoe size to get water at noon in a Palestinian country and to be there by yourself. It was a trade route there. The route that Shechem was on and Sychar was on ran all the way to the Mediterranean Sea. And so it was not a safe place for her to be by herself. But she didn't have any option. And so there's a woman that's lonely. Here's a woman that's considered unclean and an outcast by everybody that's spiritual. And she runs into a Jew who would have considered her without even knowing her to be unclean simply because she was what? A Samaritan. And so she still has her moral life covered up. She's in ill repute in her mind in Jesus' eye because she's a Samaritan, but certainly this stranger doesn't know about who I am in the community. And that's going to change. What else? Jesus violated at least four cultural norms in here. Four of them. And we're going to talk about these near the end. One of them was geography. And there's a lot of debate about this, disagreement, I should say, about this route. But a devout Jew, a conservative Jew, if they had to go from Jerusalem to Galilee, would have left Jerusalem, headed east to Jericho, would have run up kind of or walked up the Jordan River Valley as close to the river as possible on the eastern side of the hills that are there. Once they saw Mount Gilboa, they would have hung a left to a place called Scythopolis, which is an Old Testament town, Bethshan, and then they would have kept right on moving to Galilee. And Jesus has to go through Samaria, it says. That can't be totally true. There were other routes. Unless he had to go through because of this encounter, which is what I think it was. Ethnicity. Jesus broke down the barriers here. He talked to a Samaritan. Matter of fact, he went a whole lot further than that. We'll see that in a second. But Jews wouldn't talk to Samaritans. And a Samaritan woman was considered unclean from birth by a Jew. And it was a racial thing. It was an ethnic thing. It had nothing else to do with anything else other than the fact that their ethnicity. Gender. A rabbi wouldn't talk to a woman in public. Some rabbis didn't even talk to their wives in public. And many men refused to talk to women at wells. And you think, well, what's wrong with that? Because of what it might appear. What do you mean? Well, Moses met his wife at a well. Jacob met Rachel at a well. Isaac's wife, Rebekah, was spotted by Abram's servant at a well. And so it was kind of a folklorish, romantic kind of notion that if you're at a well and you're talking to a woman, you might be trying to propose, you might be trying to woo her, you might be trying to bring her to yourself. Matter of fact, there's even at least the remote possibility, maybe it's not even remote, when she said, I have no husband, that's what she was saying. I'm available. And Jesus, boy, Jesus just nails that right away. Doesn't even let that go anywhere. So wells were, and talking to women was off limits. And she was of low status. She was also an outcast. Jesus knew that. She's the one that's the most shocked. How is it that you, a Jew, are talking to me, a Samaritan who is a woman? She says there's two reasons you shouldn't be talking to me. And Jesus basically lays out another one when he talks to her about her moral life. But he crossed all of these boundaries. He tore them down. And the story is also about what I would call total immersion. This is not a story about an encounter. What do I mean? Jesus spent 2 days in Sychar. If you read the account, 2 days. That means he slept in their beds. That means he ate their food. It means he answered their questions. And I would go so far as to say there's at least a likelihood that he did some healing while he was there. He's there for 2 days. He didn't just pass through, run into this woman. This isn't talking to someone on the airplane or the ski lift. Someone that you wouldn't normally associate with. This is going out of your way to enter into a geographical, ethnic, social setting that everything in your culture says you shouldn't do. And not because of danger, but because it's either wrong or what would people think. How about the world of the text? This is some interesting stuff in here. Worship. 12 times the word is used in the book of John. 10 of them are in 5 verses. In this little 10 times the word worship is used in 5 verses in this little story. It's Jesus' most extensive, I want you to hear this, recorded teaching on worship. And it's not in John chapter 3. Talking to whom? Nicodemus. It's in John chapter 4, talking to a social outcast who he had no business on earth, according to the norms of his day, to talk to. And he does some serious... You will not find Jesus talking about worship anymore. Any more than this, any place else in the Gospels. He also talks about spirit and truth. And he says, Jesus says, these are the two pillars, I use that word, of genuine worship. And then he goes on to say that Jerusalem had it wrong. And you say, where do you get that? She says, you say that in Jerusalem you're supposed to worship. My fathers say it's on this mountain. We have the ruins of the temple. Turn around, Jesus, and there's some ruins up there that your people destroyed the true temple. And Jesus says, the day is coming, it's now here, when neither on this mountain or in Jerusalem will people worship. For God is looking for people to worship him in spirit and in truth. Jerusalem had it wrong because they had no spirit. That was the whole point of Jesus' dialogue with Nicodemus, wasn't it? Flesh gives birth only to flesh. It's the spirit that gives birth to spirit. Nicodemus, you got the law, but it's dead. It's empty. You got the truth, but you have no spirit. You've only got half of it. Gerizim had it wrong because they had no truth. What do I mean? There's 4 pillars in the Samaritan religion. The first one is, there is only one God, the God of Israel. Second one, there is only one prophet, Moses, the son of Amram. Third one, there is only one Pentateuch, the Torah, given through Moses. And there's only one holy temple, one holy mountain, Mount Gerizim. You see, the Samaritans had rejected every other book of the Old Testament except the first five. It's called the Samaritan Pentateuch. They rejected all the prophets except for Moses. And Jesus says, you worship, you remember this? You worship what you do not know. You haven't got it. For salvation is from the Jews. The Messiah is to come from the Jews, not the Samaritans. If you had the rest of God's revelation, you would have known that. And so he says, you had it wrong. He goes on to talk about spirit and truth some more. We'll let that go. The word seek is a huge word in this book. 32 times it's used in John's gospel. I about died when I found that out. And I kind of stumbled into this looking at the conversation between Jesus and the woman. It's a gospel about what people seek. If you just take the word seek, and this is the Greek word so this is every single time it's the exact same word. You'll be surprised at all the things that people seek or don't seek, or why they seek certain things that are in this gospel. It's used 12 times in this book to talk about the Jews that when they were seeking to destroy Jesus, seeking to kill him. Jesus said elsewhere, I came, not in this gospel, but he said, I came to seek and to save that which was lost. I want you to kind of file that away. It's important. We're going to get back to that. But it goes on. There's more. John, first chapter, the gospel opens. John the Baptizer says, behold the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. And he's pointing at Jesus. Two of his disciples, one of them was Andrew, went and started following Jesus. Jesus turns around at the very beginning of the gospel and he says, what are you looking for? What are you seeking? The gospel ends with that. Mary Magdalene in the garden tomb area. Everyone else runs off and she's still there and she thinks he's the gardener. And Jesus says, whom are you seeking? Who are you looking for? Isn't that amazing? It opens and it closes with this idea of seeking. And then Jesus' own disciples come back from the town and they're thinking this. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in our scriptures. They're thinking to themselves, what are you looking for? John tells us they didn't say, what are you seeking? Or why are you talking to this woman? Now, why did John put that in there? Good going, boys. I surely would have thought you would have said both of those things, but you didn't. So you get an A in biblical behavior. I don't think so. I think they were going through their minds. They're kind of looking at each other. What is she doing here? What's he doing talking to her? But they didn't say it to Jesus, and they didn't say it to her. And I'm convinced the reason they didn't say it to her because she was talking to Jesus. And Jesus explodes their theology. This is the part that I want you to get. He just explodes all of this and introduces the idea of a seeking God. Those who worship God must worship him in spirit and in truth. For such people, God, it's a present tense in the Greek, beloved. God is seeking and seeking and seeking. God is looking. I was going to read until I realized how long it was. There's an old poem called The Hound of Heaven. If you've not read it, you need to find it and read it. It's way too long, but it's about a person that was just running from God, and God is after him. It's good poetry. I'm sure the person's been dead a long time, but that helps sometimes. Okay. The world before the text, that's you and I. And we're going to take a look at four pictures of Christ. I think one of them is that we have a conversational Christ. These are going to kind of rhyme and bounce, and that just happened that way, I think. A conversational Christ. He was not, and this is important, I think, he was not afraid to ask for help from an unbeliever. Jesus said, give to me to drink. In our modern vernacular, it would probably have come out like, would you please give me some water? He spoke to her. He asked her to help him. And the question for you and I in the 21st century is, how often have you and I ever said to an unbeliever, would you be willing, or would you have time, would you be interested in helping me with? If you're like me, I find myself kind of, I'm not sure where we picked this up. I have this theory called the restroom of life, where there's all this graffiti in there with these things that, you know, when people say, well, you know what they say, I think that's where it's written. But somewhere along the line, we picked up the idea that we are the ones that always have to do all the giving and all the ministering and all the serving. And it would be wrong to ever somehow communicate to an unbeliever that we really need them. And I would just like to challenge you with that thought tonight. There may be someone in your life, at work, a neighborhood, or whatever, that one of the most spiritual things you could do would be to let them know that they can be of service and help to you. Curiosity and getting involved in people's lives and creating a context where conversation happens is becoming a lost art. Jesus struck up a conversation with this woman. Now, granted, he knew where it was going. But it started out with him asking her for help. And you say, well, he was the Son of God. He didn't need help. Yeah, he did. Read the text. He was weary from the journey. Well, that's just what it says. He wasn't really weary. That's right. He wasn't really weary. That's why he fell asleep in a boat. I mean, you know, he was tired. He was thirsty. And he said, could I please have a drink of water? And look where it went. He was also a controversial Christ. And this is a touchy one, but he rejected ethnic categories that violated the will of God, the heart of God. Jesus had no place for them. And the question for you and I, a hard question, but I think an important question, is how closely does my view of family match Jesus' view of family in Matthew 12? They came to him and they said, your mother and your sisters and your brothers are at the door. And Jesus says, who is my mother and my sister and my brothers? He says, truly I say to you, those who do the will of God are my sister and my mother and my brother. And one of the things I want to lay out tonight, and this is a very delicate subject, but I think it's important for us, and it's just a question. When you think of who is in your family or who you have the most in common with, how closely does it match this? Let me give you some examples. Do you and I believe that we are really closer and have more in common with, I happen to be white skin, but my mom's half Indian, Native American. Do I believe, as a Caucasian, that I have more in common with an African American or a Latino or an Asian Christian than I do a white unbeliever? If I don't see it that way, it's not biblical. Do I believe that I have more in common and closer in heart in terms of what matters to God with, if I'm a Republican, with a Democrat believer, than I do a Republican unbeliever? Now, I know I'm meddling here, but I want you to think about this. We can do it with sports affiliation. We can do it with political persuasions. We can do it with geography. All right? I have more in common being from outside this part of the country with you than I do with people north of here that are unbelievers. And the same is true flipping it around. And Jesus was not threatened in talking with the Samaritan woman. And out of that came a revival of citywide proportions. He wouldn't have stayed there 2 days. You try and find how many places in the Gospels where Jesus put this kind of time into one place. It's amazing. And I could talk to you forever on this, but I'm convinced that if the world would see God's people committed to Matthew 12, 47 through 50, they would have no explanation for it except the Spirit of God. That's the only basis for racial healing and for ethnic healing in this land. Third thing. He was a conciliatory Christ. What do I mean by that? He was seeking people. Just like Paul says in 2 Corinthians 5, God was in Christ reconciling the world unto himself, and he has given us the ministry of reconciliation. Therefore, we are Christ's ambassadors, and we're begging you to be reconciled to God. Jesus wanted this woman. He wasn't giving her a theology lesson about God. God is looking for these kind of people, of which you obviously are not one. I think Jesus is saying God is looking for you. And I'm convinced that she came to know the Lord right there. How do I know that? Because she left her stinking water pot at the well. That's how I know. She said, give me this water. And Jesus said, whoever drinks of this water will not thirst anymore. She split and left it parked there. And I think she came to know him. Question, do I think to myself when I'm looking into the eyes of an unbeliever, does this thought ever cross my mind? God is looking for you. God is looking for you. And please don't go omniscient, God's omniscience on me here. Go back to Genesis chapter 3. First words that come out of God's mouth after the fall are what? Adam, where are you? You know, we do the math. It's his garden. He's omniscient. He knows where he is, for crying out loud. But he's looking. He wants Adam to know he's looking for him. Last one, he was a conditional Christ. Jesus told her under no uncertain terms that worship is always on God's terms, not ours. It's always on God's terms, not ours. Question for you and I, is my worship built on truth or my own opinion? The Jews and the Samaritans had it wrong on the issue of truth. And is my worship on spirit-led passion or human routine? Is it truth? Is it spirit and truth? And beloved, worship is a big deal in America right now. They call it the worship movement and a whole bunch of other stuff. This is an important verse. And that's all I'm going to say. This is an important verse. Because these are the people God's seeking to worship him. People who worship in spirit and truth. And truth is worshiping the way God wants us to. And that's in the scriptures. Those are four good questions. And I think it would be good. I think there would be some value. And for you, if you're married or if you have a friend, to ask them what they think you think about each of these questions. Or just pick two. Just pick two. It's kind of like Panera, right? They have a menu item called You Pick Two. And this is the light church. We're not heavy here. You can pick two of the four. So I'm just teasing. Let me pray. Father, thank you so much for this account, this story.